The first thing that I'm curious about since you all just arrived is how was the bike journey, and can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. You want to take that or shall I? Okay. So Kathy and I started bike touring in 2005. That's when our youngest daughter took off for college, left us with an empty nest, and by happenstance, we took a month off to get together again after raising a family and being involved in our careers, and we happened to do a bike ride. And it was so recreational, in the best sense of the word, that we've done it every year since. And so we were, this year, looking for an excuse to do something like that. And this popped up. And so we jumped at the chance. So that's why we did it. And it's not our longest ride, but it's probably our second, third, maybe third longest ride. And it's just such a great lifestyle. You know, it's just, if it were a food, it would be almost the perfect food. We look at bike riding as, well, what does it do for you? And this is maybe a little overdone, but I like to think of, you know, we're looking for meaning in our life, and I like the way Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning defines meaning. He says, you know, we find meaning in accomplishment. Well, okay, that's check that one. And in beauty, in appreciating beauty. Well, okay, got that one too. And in meeting challenges, and in relationship. And then the last one he does is in service. What are you doing to make the world a better place, or to serve others? And it doesn't do that one. It's very, you know, so it's, like I say, it's almost the perfect activity. It's not quite. So that's why if we can do it, if people can benefit from it in some way, we like the fundraising for this type of thing. It's really a nice benefit that we can't do by ourselves, so it's fun that way.
So can you talk a little bit more about the fundraising and how that aspect was added into this idea?
Yeah, so we were gonna ride our bikes back here anyway, but I'd been in touch with your coach, Alex La Pena, and with Lisa Thurer in the alumni donor office in the past anyway, because we did a little bit of stuff earlier in the spring, and just said, hey, if you can use this as a framework for a fundraising effort, that's great. And so Craig Jance, the senior associate director of athletics, and Lisa and Alex and Ray Oppenheimer just took off with it, and they did this fabulous job of organizing it and put out a lot of publicity and that type of stuff, which is a little embarrassing to us, but nonetheless it still was pretty effectively done. And so they've raised a lot of money, which is really cool, but it's really been all their work, and it's been like, I think there's almost 50 donors now, so it's been effective at getting some funds, because as you know, colleges aren't exactly financially flush these days, and so any extra benefit we can do on the side that would make for as rich an experience for current student athletes as we had is, you really want to try to make that available, because it's been such a good experience for us in the past.
Well, we really appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you so much. So I guess when I think about going on a journey this far, like, I feel like the thought of even just starting is so daunting. So what did it feel like when you first started in Seattle getting ready to do this? Was it exciting? Were you nervous?
It's exciting. It even, I think, after 14 years of doing this, with a couple of years off, I had knee replacements and had a wedding with the family and such as that. But every year, the good news, we have it down, we have our packing lists, and we know how to travel now. We know what we've done, we know what works for us. And so it's easier that way, and that makes it more exciting and less daunting. On the other hand, it's still a lot of work, you know, getting who's gonna pay, how to pay the bills and getting them all, you know, got a house to run even though you're not there, how do you do that? So it is a bit daunting. On the other hand, we've done it often enough now that it's, we have it pretty well down. Did I say that right?
Yeah, okay. Pretty well down. Always a few things.
But it is, but even so, we got back from our a longer trip last year in just almost exactly a year before we left for this trip. It's been a year since we got back from a 5-month trip. And it felt strange starting out again. And it said, you gotta get your legs back under you and kind of get used to the rhythms again. As an example, the first K camping night we had, we took the train actually from Seattle to Whitefish, Montana, because we were going to leave from home, but we got behind. I had to break down equipment. I had a special order and we lost a little time. So we biked from Whitefish to the base of the climb to Mount Logan Pass and going to Sun Highway Glacier Park. And we got up early in the morning so we could ride the roads when they were dark. And the people, the masses of humanity that are tourists in Glacier Park in the August wouldn't be clogging the roads. And so we got up at 4 in the morning and were on the road as quickly as we could get. But what we found is our first night, we were so inefficient at packing up. You know, you get into a rhythm, and here we were all thumbs and clumsy trying to get packed up again. So it's that kind of reorientation that you have to go through each year.
So were you camping mostly or staying in hotels, or how did that work?
Well, we're supposed to, according to our plans, camp most of the time. And it's easy. We're you know, totally self-sufficient that way. But we're also getting older, and we do have options, and we use those options. For instance, as soon as we got into or across parts of North Dakota, the weather systems were just wild. We had these violent thunderstorms coming through every once in a while around us, and so we're always watching the weather forecast and the winds because they determine your progress. And we were dancing around these thunderstorms day after day for a week, 2 weeks at a time.
Oh, gosh.
There's one point in Wisconsin, and so if it was going to be a real thunderstorm, we'd get a hotel because we didn't want to be out in our with our metal frame bikes, steel bikes, and tending in an open field someplace. So we camped a lot more than we probably ordinarily would because of those. And then we got to the Midwest, and it was hitting upper 80s and 90 degrees. And while we can tolerate that temperature better on a bike than a runner could, because we have a breeze cooling us off, you get really dehydrated and hot. And so we would tend to pull into air conditioning places and camp. So we camp probably a little bit less than we wanted to, but nonetheless, half the time. Somewhere around there.
Maybe a little under.
Oh, that's still so impressive. And how long was the total journey?
We left August 20th by train. And it's a beautiful Amtrak ride from Seattle overnight through the mountains to Whitefish, Montana. So we slept and watched and left from there. So August 21st from Whitefish, and we got in yesterday. So about 6 to 7 weeks. And we took it. I think we had 2 or 3 days off. Three or four days off.
Only? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So what would an average day look like?
Well, we tend to get up early because it's always, always, always nicer riding in the morning than later in the day. You're fresher, the air is cooler, there's less traffic. And so we tend to get up 5:30, 6 o'clock, about the same time you get up for your morning workout.
Yeah. I think yours is a little harder.
So you're all prepared for this in the future. And it takes us a half hour to pack up everything and reload it onto the bikes, fold the tent up and get our sleep bags stuffed and everything back on the bikes. And then we'll either eat breakfast in camp with some oatmeal and raisins and peanut butter mixed in, add a little body, and a mandarin orange or something for something sweet, and some instant coffee, which is, if you got to, I guess you got to, type stuff. And then we hit the road by, if we're lucky, 7:30, and if we're not lucky, 8 to 8:30, and if we're really unlucky, 9 o'clock. But a lot of times, if we're close, we love to go to a small town cafe where all the locals hang out and get a really big breakfast, a 3-egg omelet, really unhealthy stuff that you wouldn't eat at home necessarily, but you can get away with it on the bike ride, so you do that.
And how far would you usually go every day?
Excuse me. We, on the days we rode this time, I'll have to go back and get the final, but I think we were averaging right about 65 miles a day.
Wow.
And that's a little more than our 69-year-old bodies usually like to do. We like to aim for 50 to 55. But because of the distances over really rural areas where resources aren't really available between two spots for either camping or motels or whatever, a lot of times we'll go further and the weather just really determine it. If it's really strong winds into your face, you go shorter. If it's behind your back, like in Montana, we had 210-mile days because we were just flying along with the tailwind, So, but we averaged somewhere around 60 to 65.
And what were some of the highlights of things that you saw along the way? We were tracking your progress on Instagram, so I'd love to hear about some of the pictures we saw.
Well, Kathy, you fill in too on this, but I think the first one was that climb over going to Sun Highway at, in the dark. You know, you never know if are there going to be bears out, you know? And so we actually had a bear spray story. So you can't, we don't carry bear spray ordinarily. A lot of people carry it to use on dogs, but we've never had a trouble with dogs. So so we got there, but we're going to go at 4 in the morning over this highway with nobody out in the middle of the night when, you know, we figured the wildlife might be more active. So we went in to buy some bear spray. It's going to be like $50, you know? I said, well, you know, as we're I'm debating that, a guy walks up and said, well, we have bear spray and we're leaving. Can we just give, we're flying out and you can't carry it on a plane, so can we just give it to you? So it's that kind of hospitality we ran to over and over again. But going to the Sun Highway at night was one highlight. Theodore Roosevelt National Park was a big highlight. It's you never hear of this park. You think of North Dakota as kind of this barren wasteland, but it's not. It's one of our favorite states now. And Theodore Roosevelt National Park is what a prairie used to look like. Right now, prairies look like wheat fields and cattle grazing and corn and whatever. But if you've ever seen a real original, what's left of untouched prairie land, it's the richest, deepest, most intricate, complex system you can imagine, with lots of wildlife and whatnot. So Theodore Roosevelt National Park has bison and lots of wildlife around it. And we got to see a bison up close, not on purpose, but you know, within a few feet by happenstance. And that was kind of exciting. And then another exciting thing, I think the general themes for me, and Kathy may feel differently on this, was that the highlights of the trip for me are two basic things. It's the getting the feel of the land at the speed of a bike. I mean, you fly over, there's no way you can look down and say, wow, that's impressive, but you don't feel it. And in a car, you can see it, but you're usually stiff and bored, you know, going across the big prairie lands. But getting a sense for how massive this country is and how diverse it is really helpful, one. And then the second is busting your myths on stereotyping people in different states. Whether it's in the South, which is what we did last year, which we really stereotyped incorrectly, or across the rural farmlands even. We found as long as you don't talk politics, people are almost universally hospitable and full of goodwill. And they got exactly the same concerns you do. And they want to do a good job, and they want to be nice, and they want to serve. Now, if you start talking politics, then these big fences come down and you're blocked in, and then it doesn't always go as smoothly. So we don't talk politics when we're out there. We just enjoy the hospitality, and there's been lots of that. So those two things, I think the people on the land, we have a saying that we think that everybody would benefit from doing these types of trips, and politicians ought to be required to do these types of trips. It would make us a healthier country.
I would love to see some of our politicians bike across the country.
Not to name any names, but yeah, so.
So then sort of the flip side, what were some of the challenges that you encountered, or were there any, Kathy had mentioned like, there were a few days where we were just happy to survive, so.
Just a few roads, it wasn't the whole day.
Okay, just a few roads, okay.
Yeah, you live kind of within nature's realm when you're biking, because you're so, you talk about what a car being 100 and some horsepower, we're, you know, a 16th horsepower, so we're very vulnerable to nature's whims. And so you have a fairly deep respect, you develop a very deep respect for nature and the power of a wind, for instance. The wind determined how our day went. If it's a tailwind, it's great. If it's a headwind, you have to shift gears a lot, and mental gears and physical gears down, and just try to learn patience. Kathy's much better at that than I am. And just go at what nature will give you. But the winds would determine a lot, and then the storms, of course, determine a lot. We were lucky. We joke that we have guardian angels. And honestly, it happens way more than coincidence would suggest it would, that we just barely escape various things, you know, big storms and whatnot. But it's happened over and over again, so we call them our guardian angels, and are very grateful to them. the challenges, I guess man-made challenges, were mostly the quality of the roads. You know, we follow back routes, farm roads. Ohio's perfect. Oh my goodness. Ohio is these mile-by-mile grid almost of paved, almost unused farm roads that we came up from Columbus without hardly ever touching a major highway. We did touch some, but not very often. But there are places in the country where there just aren't any choices. You have to be on roads, and they may not have wide shoulders, and they may have trucks going 70 miles an hour, and that's, we call it adrenaline pumping, and we really don't like to do that. You're just so vulnerable to somebody not paying attention. The truckers are professional drivers, and they're pretty good, but, you know, the 75-year-old RVers, you worry a lot about. And so I think that was the biggest worry we had, but it really was such a small part of the trip. Almost always we were on pretty good roads, yeah.
And so this whole trip was leading up to coming back to Oberlin. What has it been like to be back on campus these past, I guess, day now?
Yeah, well, I think you'll have to ask Kathy that, because she hasn't been back since 1972 or
3. Oh, wow.
I was back last year for President Ambar's inauguration,
okay,
and for the dedication of the new pool,
mm-hmm,
and gym facilities. So I got to catch up a lot back then. And then we were here in 2000. I was here in 2006 for my coach, Dick Michael's retirement, which drew several hundred of his former athletes because,
wow,
he was a very popular guy. And so I'm going to look at, do you want to talk, Jason? What's it like?
Well, yesterday we came in and we immediately had a rainstorm. And it just seemed gray, and the people were indoors and the campus didn't seem vibrant, but today it's burst open. And so it's just really been wonderful to just see all folks all out and the activity on campus. I've gotten to go in and be a little discouraged at what Carnegie Library doesn't have anymore, but delighted at what Mudd does have, and spent some time in there looking at some things, and the folks were all gracious and wonderful and helpful, and the students all are look comfortable and dedicated and busy, and so it's feeling like home again.
You gotta realize Mudd Library did not exist when you graduated.
Yeah, it was all in Carnegie,
it
right?
Was only Carnegie.
Okay.
Yeah.
So also the other part of your time here is that you're being inducted into the Athletic Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that experience, how you're feeling about it? Were you surprised? Is it always something that you wanted?
Well, I was surprised. I got called by Dick Michaels, who nominated me. He's my former coach for both cross country and track. And he said he was nominating me, and it was kind of a bolt out of the blue. And I wasn't certainly anticipating it. I'd seen some of the other swimmers get in, and they clearly deserved it, you know. There have been some fantastic All-American swimmers through here, including national champions, three different ones. So it was a little bit of a surprise, but it's one of the nicer things I could have gotten, because you don't come to Oberlin strictly to do sports. But that being said, for me, sports was a pretty integral part of the college experience. And not so much as an extracurricular activity, but as really part of the overall college education. So it played an outsized role. It was very important to me. I was very dedicated to it. And the teammates and the coach were all very important. So it's a great honor for me. I'm really happy and pleased about it. And I'm just grateful, I guess.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, since I'm also a swimmer, and I think like we get all the legends passed down from all the past generations. So I'm always curious to talk to former swimmers, especially I feel like I was talking to Alex, Coach Alex, about this today. But it seems like your sort of era of swimmers are really just still huge supporters of the team, really care about the team. So I'm curious to know what your experience was swimming here, and like what was the team culture like, and how does it compare?
Well, my particular group, my class of 1972, was a transitional group. Before us, we had the great Steve Stitt, Mike Jarvis era. That they actually called that the Steve Stitt, Mike Jarvis era, the first two All-Americans in swimming in the Oberlin's history. And they were absolute legends. I overlapped with Mike Jarvis, Iron Mike they called him, because he'd do the 500, 200 fly and 1,000 every day. And And he was an amazing guy, there's no question about it. My group had some wonderful people, absolutely, and good swimmers. But as soon as we left, matter of fact, I was an All-American, but there were five of us in 1972 who were All-Americans. And as I left, Tom Geiger came in the next year and wiped out all my records and took my, they didn't even miss me at all.
Oh, no.
So at least he waited till I was gone. So we were transitioned kind of between the old group, which went 11-0, beat Kenyon College in dual meet.
Those were the days, were I guess.
And Kenyon at that point had won 15 straight conference titles.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So they were, it wasn't like they were pushovers. They were a powerhouse.
Yeah.
And so they were the legends before, and really, after Dick Michaels got here, he built this whole legends afterwards. So we were kind of a transition period. I'll tell you the biggest issue I have that I regret is that when we got here, there was no women's swimming. Mm. There was no track, women's track or cross country. It was pre-Title IX. And I had come from high school where we had co-ed teams. And for some reason, I didn't register it when I got here or think it was strange or protest it or wonder about it. And I've kicked myself ever since, especially since there's a psychology major several years ago that did their senior thesis on women in sport at Oberlin. And one of the alumni sent that out to our group to review. And I read that and I said, well, holy smokes, there's a lot going on. I didn't have any clue. And so I think the biggest deficit was that we had a great experience on the guys' team, but the women did not have that opportunity, and we didn't have the opportunity to be on a co-ed team with the women either, so it goes both ways. So that's my biggest regret, I think. Otherwise, it was just a terrific experience that has really helped throughout the years, actually. It wasn't just the college experience. The benefits really lasted into the future.
I feel like it's really surprising to hear that there wasn't swimming, and I mean, I knew that, but especially since Oberlin is like the first college to admit women alongside men, it's really surprising to me that it took so long for athletics to catch up. Do you have any sense of why that was, and was it something people talked about, or it was just that's the way it is?
I think that the battle for equality is an ongoing battle, and you can't take things for granted. And I think back in the 60s and early 70s, Oberlin patted itself on the back a lot for its past. Mm-hmm. But if you read that paper that the psychology guy did, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, I think you'll find there was a lot of gender discrimination still going. It was really hard to get equal representation in the phys ed department and the coaching staff, equal resource management. When they built Phelps Gym, it was for the men's gym.
Really?
It was for men's gym. And the women were still supposed to use Hales.
So it was separated.
It was separated.
Oh, wow.
And that got protested and switched around, fortunately. But that's where things were. That was 1970, you know? So there was a lot more difficulty in making changes than you would anticipate. Title IX hadn't passed yet. And Title IX passed, and someone told me 72 or 73, but it was not implemented until 75 or so. Hmm. So it wasn't actually kicking into gear yet on a national level. So I'm sure you know the story of Dick Michaels and the women's cross country team. Has that come through?
I've heard the outline of it, but if you'd like to tell more,
well,
I'd love to hear.
This was after I graduated. So I graduated in 72. In 1973, Dick Michaels, who coached cross country and swimming, was approached by several women who'd run in high school and said, hey, can we train with your cross country team? He said, well, sure. You know, so they trained with the cross country team. And then he said, you know, we can't, I can't, you can run in the meets, but it has to be exhibition because we can't score, you know, women at this point. So they said, okay. And they showed up for the Ohio Wesleyan meet, and the Ohio Wesleyan coach said, they can't run. And he said, it says right here in the rule book, he pulled out the Ohio Athletic Conference rule book, it said, for men in good standing. He said, they can't run. So Dick Michaels said, well, they trained, they're going to run. And so the Ohio Wesleyan coach pulled his team off the field, refused to run, and filed a protest with the Ohio Athletic Conference, who censured Dick Michaels for that effort. So in spite of that, the next year, the Ohio Athletic Conference Rules Committee met and they changed the wording in the bylaws to take out the men, the student standing. So he was really, though you never would have guessed it meeting him the first time because he was pretty irreverent, nonetheless, he stood up, you know, when he didn't have to.
Was that the only women's team on campus at that point?
There wasn't. It was not the only field. There was field hockey, remember? And Jane Litton, bless her heart, who's in the Heisman Hall of Fame, was instrumental in joining or developing further, at least, I don't know if she started, but the fencing club. Fencing club. And she went on to become a world-ranked epee and foil fencer, national champion in the United States, not college division, everybody. Wow. So she was our class, and so she was stepping forward and doing stuff. Kathy played basketball, but it was in its infancy, and not as well recognized or funded, certainly. You know, they played out of Hale's gym, you know, and she may have told you the kind of some interesting rules of.
Yeah, I heard half court,
three dribbles, half court, defensive and offensive players, three each. That moved to a full court for five-person game in my junior year, if I remember correctly, which may not be right.
But there wasn't the infrastructure and support, you know, that there was for the men's teams. And that was an ongoing battle for several years.
I think it's really interesting now, and obviously it's a very different culture, but Oberlin now is sort of known for internally having this divide between athletes and non-athletes. And it's sort of usually talked about as South Campus is all of the conservatory people and all of the people who aren't athletes, and then North Campus is stereotypically, obviously it's not true in every sense, but generally athletes who are living closer to the gym. So I'm curious if that existed at all when you all were here.
That's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. I will say your freshman year, you just got scattered. Everybody got scattered across dorms all over the place. The sophomore year, we had a, quote, jock, end quote, floor at an east dorm.
Really?
And so a lot of football players. I was there. There's a couple swimmers. There's a mix of folks, but there are a lot of football players up there. It wasn't your typical football players. They had a bridge league going, you know, and stuff. It was pretty interesting.
Oberlin athletes.
So I guess there was a little bit of that. North was kind of a little more ritzy dorm at that point. It was new. But a lot of our friends were not. You spent a lot of time with your teammates, mm-hmm. obviously, and so they are obviously your friends, and you spent, because it's such a time commitment to make. But I didn't think of us as separate from the college. I mean, one of my dorm mates was a cellist, a big black guy named Bill Thomas, who was one of the loveliest people I've ever. And one night, on Friday night, we were going out and said, "Hey, Bill, what are you going to do?" And he said, "I'm going to go down to the conservatory and jam with my string quartet." And I said, "What are you talking about?" So is that kind of eye-opening to me to see somebody as passionate about their cello. Well, more probably passionate, more capable anyway than I was about swimming. But it's that kind of mixing that I thought was really helpful. So I never would have thought of us as separate from the college. There were different groups. I mean, there was French House and African-American House and Spanish House. And there were different groups that kind of lived together. But so I don't know if it's really different now or just different kind of perspective or perception, I guess.
Yeah, I think from my perspective as an athlete who's lived on South Campus for three of my 4 years here, so sort of like breaking that stereotype, yeah. I think it is very much about, like, if you want those opportunities to mix with people who are different from you or have different interests, it's there, but it is a matter of sort of breaking out of those formed groups. So it sounds like it's sort of similar, but I think that there's like an institutional or a cultural perception that athletes and other students are sort of like different types of people.
It is interesting because you can break it down different ways. And I guess one thing I'd say is, well, academically speaking, it wasn't us dumb jocks versus the rest of them. That was very clear. I mean, Dave Shipley, who's on the Board of Trustees now, graduated with highest honors in history. Our classmate, Bill Little, was a 4-point summa cum laude in physics, and both of them went on to have spectacular national careers. Bill, may he rest in peace, because he died of a heart attack, was this, you know, chairman of the American Board of Cardiology for the country. So we didn't have, you know, I'd match our swim team academically against anybody. I mean, just a fantastic group of scholar athletes. So you can't break it down as dumb jocks versus the rest. So it's not that. So you'd have to break it down as well as a different attitude somehow and how that could, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think the athletes who do end up at Oberlin are here for similar reasons to what you said, because it is very academic and because they want to be athletes who are playing bridge or, you know, who are also in the conservatory. I think it's an interesting sort of cultural phenomenon that a lot of the students right now are sort of trying to break down and figure out why it's there. Yeah. But
I wonder if it's different here than at, I'm sure it's different here than at D1 schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ken Nelson, who one of the alumni from my class, who's back, who you met downstairs, was just mentioning it before we came up about one of our swimmers, Rich Lehman, who as a teenager has a picture of himself on the award stand as a 12-year-old, I think, with two Olympic medalists in second and third place, including Mitch Ivey, who was a silver medalist, and I think it was Mark Spitz, maybe the other guy.
Wow.
So he was absolutely a national class swimmer, and he came here to swim. But he, like you, took his junior year abroad. And so one of the points about D3 is, well, you know, the athletics are important. They're important for a lot of reasons, not just your final sports performance, but everything else that it brings. And you do have the flexibility in D3. You could never do that at D1. You'd lose your scholarship. I mean, you just couldn't do it. So that type of thing, I think, is one of the reasons that D3 athletic experiences is so valuable.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely something that drew me here.
Yeah.
As far as other things, then this maybe idea of the non-athlete-athlete divide, have you noticed from coming back either last year or this year any major differences in like student culture? Or I know you haven't spent a lot of time with the team yet, but team culture for the swim team?
Well, I think it makes a difference having a co-ed team.
Yeah.
I think it's a richer, more healthy experience, actually. So that's a big difference. Otherwise, we haven't spent enough time on campus to know. We just feel like old grumpy people walking along, you know, like I'm sure everybody looks up and says, oh, who are those old people walking through the campus, you know? So we haven't really had enough time to get a sense of things, I think. It looks like a vibrant place, you know, that's all I can say.
So I'd love to hear also more about your all's experience when you were here at Oberlin, maybe more broadly than just athletics, but anything that you really remember as being central to your experience here?
Well, remember, we were here during the Vietnam War, and we were here in 1970 when the Kent State shootings occurred. Mm. And we had a mass meeting that night at Finney Chapel, the whole thing they called a mass meeting, urgent mass meeting, and some of the students from Kent State came up and talked about one of their classmates dying in their arms that day.
Wow.
So that that shut down the school, actually. The school actually shut down for the last 2 weeks. That was in May, so they shut down the school, and there's a lot of protesting. People went to D.C., you know, loaded trucks and went up to D.C. to protest and whatnot. So there's a lot of student activism around the war. It was a pretty liberal place. And there wasn't a lot of sentiment for the war on the student side. I know one student who coincidentally had a draft number of 300 and something who was a little more conservative. But it was pretty active. So that was a dominating theme. The civil rights movement was still pretty active, although its peak in 64, in the early 60s on, had kind of come down a little bit, so there wasn't the fervency there, I think, although still it was hardly that it was a one battle. I think the Vietnam War dominated things a lot. Other themes. Well, you know, we saved a lot of the old Oberlin reviews. And so it's interesting to go back and watch the Apollo's advertisement for this brand new movie called Space Odyssey. that kind of stuff. So it's fun to go back and see all the advertisements and what was printed at that time. Oh, interesting. I did see one. You know, my parents got the Oberlin Review so they could read about the sports that they didn't grow anything else. And so they happened to put those all in a big pile, and I got to go through them not that long ago. And I actually cut out, I don't know if they'll use it tomorrow in the talk, but I cut out some of the article's editorials. And there was one by, who was the history professor? Martha Kolish, I think, who wrote a beautiful article, it's either her or her colleague, on the difficulty with gender equality in the faculty in the 1970s. Mm. So it wasn't just sports. She talked about how few women were advanced, how the pay differential, sound familiar?
Yeah, and this sadly.
Stuff, this letter you're reading, you say, whoa, you know, that's pretty powerful stuff for 1970 when all this was going down and people thought we were so advanced. Mm. So that was a big theme. We you know, I don't know if you remember this one, but or heard about this one, but we got written up in Life magazine.
For the co-ed dorms,
the co-ed
right?
The co-ed dorms and the Saturday night identity crisis, end quote. Quote, Saturday night identity crisis, end quote, at Oberlin College.
What does that mean?
Oh, you know, poor me, you know, people getting all self-pity or what would be the right word?
Worried,
angst over...
Failing everything.
Over life in general.
Like what life holds.
Anyway, we got written up in a not too complimentary way. But I think most people took that with a grain of salt and said, yeah.
Well, I think it's also really interesting that at the same time that there were all these issues with gender equality in faculty and in sports and probably other areas also at Oberlin, they were also introducing co-ed dorms, and that
yes.
Like Oberlin can be this place that's both very progressive and somehow still behind in a lot of ways. And I think that's a theme in Oberlin's history.
I think that's perfect. I think you're exactly right. Yeah. You know, my sister went to Oberlin and graduated 2 years ahead of me. And when she came, the guys had to wear a coat and tie. It was formal sit-down dinner with waiters and waitresses. And when I got here, it was sit-down dinners, except for the athletes because they got late dinner. But it was formal sit-down. I had dinners. There used to be a little, I don't know if they still have it, a dining room in Fairchild. Little dorm, red brick dorm. It was sit. I didn't have to wear a tie, a coat, but it was formal sit-down. You had a waiter waiting, you know, and you were expected to be there at dinner time, you know. So it changed from that to more freewheeling and co-ed dorms and co-ed bathrooms.
Yeah.
In the dorms.
Yeah.
That was new when we were here. That made a lot of parents fairly concerned.
Do you remember your parents wondering about that or asking about that?
No, I think they were pretty comfortable. Yeah. I think they were pretty comfortable with us. We were pretty straight. I mean, I think Kathy and I were both pretty straight, actually, as far as that goes. And maybe that's the cultural difference that you're talking about. I felt I needed to be, because we were getting up like you are, at 6 in the morning, hitting the water, hitting the weights, hitting something, and then again in the afternoon, you couldn't afford to be staying up late, you couldn't afford to be using drugs in any way. It just wasn't healthy. You couldn't get by with it. You had to be more efficient with your time.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that's a difference with most of the student body, because I don't think most of the student body are druggers and abusing themselves. But we didn't. We chose to be pretty straight, and I did in part because I just sports was such a big part of my life.
Right. And you all met here also. We should mention.
We were both chemistry majors.
Okay.
And I actually went with someone else for a couple of years, and he was a wonderful person, and God bless her. But it worked out very, very well. I mean, I'm very fortunate with the life partner that we wound up to get. At least I'm lucky. I'm not sure if she is, but I'm lucky. Yeah, it worked out very well.
I think there's some statistic, I don't know how accurate it is, but it's like one out of every four OBs marries another OB.
It's just one out of four? I thought it was like three.
Is it more than that?
I thought it was like 70 or 80%.
I don't think it's that much.
Okay, it's not that much.
I'm sure it's a statistic you can find.
Yeah, well, I'll have to look it up.
It's 100%, so.
That's all that matters. Yeah. Was that common, though, in your class for people to marry each other?
I thought so. We were starting to marry a lot later than the generation before us. Hmm. I mean, my brother, who's 7 years older than me, got married right out of college. And a couple of our class got married within a year getting out of college, but it was getting long. You know, we waited longer. We got married at 25, which was waiting quite a while at that point. And now, the 25 is, you know, nobody gets married that early anymore. So that was changing. The cultural norms were changing that way, I think.
And so sort of moving to after Oberlin, how did your experience here shape what you did afterwards?
I was very focused. I've stayed this my whole life, focused on physical fitness. And so having the combination of running and swimming was really, really helpful to me. I just always made an effort to keep working. Even through med school, there's no access to pools. I mean, they just cut open your head and pour stuff into it as fast as they can, and slopping around in there, and just you're panicking, you're just trying to keep up, you know. But you can always run. And so the experience here just gave me a real appreciation for taking care of yourself. We have a saying in medicine is that you can't take care of others if you can't take care of yourself. You've got to be able to do that. And taking care of yourself physically is very helpful. And it also helps with your mental aspect if you can be fresh. So that's partly why I'm a morning person, is because there's nothing competing for your time at 6 in the morning. You know, there's no meetings then. Everybody's asleep. The world's asleep. It's a nice time to work out. But so the physical part of things was very helpful. The team experience, I don't know if anybody's going to go to the talk tomorrow. I'm spilling all the beans right now. But the physical or the team experience was incredibly important to me. I'm a physician in the field of rehabilitation medicine. So I spent my whole career working with a large team of healthcare professionals, PTs and OTs and speech pathologists and recreation therapists and social workers and nurses and psychologists and vocational counselors and physicians and other specialty and nurse practitioners, and just as huge teams working with people that have sometimes severe to profound strokes and brain injuries and spinal cord injuries and amputations and muscular dystrophy and multiple sclerosis and all that kind of stuff, brain tumors. And you had to be an inclusive team. Everybody is critical. So if you're not used to working, if you're used to being the boss or the star, it just doesn't work as well. You know, so it's kind of the lifeblood of my profession is to have an inclusive team. And I think that's important because you can have a team, and the team experience is a lot different if it's not a really inclusive group, if the stars get all the attention, it doesn't work as well. You got to have everybody feeling really important. And I don't know what you guys do these days, but when we were swimming, the statistic that at the end of the season that they kept, there was always the most interesting and valuable. I mean, the accolades for individuals was important and the team record was important. But every year, they would take everybody's improvement in times from season best to conference meet, where they made the finals or didn't make the finals, whatever, and add them all up and see how big that number could get. So everybody was part of that. You know, it didn't matter where you finished, you could still take big time drops, and people did. And so I think that was really helpful in making everybody feel a part of the team and that they've accomplished things and whatnot. So that was very helpful to me to do that.
So sort of to start wrapping up. If that's okay with you.
Yeah.
I guess my question would be, what is your advice to current students, or what would you tell current Oberlin students? And I know that's a really broad question, but you can take that however you want.
That's, you know, I feel like it's hard looking back, because we tend to look through rose-colored glasses about, oh, how great it was. And I know how hard, you know, when I stop to think about it, it was really hard. There is anxiety, there is depression, there is serious, you know, stresses involved in being here, or in school, I suppose, and not being sure of the direction that you're going. And so I guess a couple thoughts are, one, it doesn't matter where you're going. Having the liberal arts background is really helpful. And like in medicine, you're way better off coming from a liberal arts background than going to some science back to school, because medicine is, yes, it's part science, but it's also mostly the art of medicine. And it's just, you're just a much richer person if you've had a more diverse education. That's one thing. So the liberal arts education. And the second thing is not to worry so much if you don't know what you're going to do. Some people know what they're going to do, and God bless them, that's great. But But a lot of us had no idea. I got drafted to serve in the Army during the Vietnam War because I didn't think I wanted to go to medical school. I wasn't sure, and I wasn't going to go to medical school because I wanted to get out of the Army, which a lot of people were doing. So my rule of thumb is that as long as you keep churning away at things, you got the background, you got skills, you know how to think. As long as you keep churning away, you'll be forced to make decisions that put you in the right place eventually. And that's what happened to me. I went to med school for exactly the wrong reason. Mm-hmm. I got a master's in exercise physiology because I was interested in exercise, obviously. And Bill Little, the guy who graduated summa cum laude in physics, his father was chairman of the physiology department at Ohio State. So I talked to him and said, well, you know, Professor Little, if I want to do research in exercise physiology, should I go to medical school or grad school? And he said, oh, well, Dave, you know, if you want to do research on humans, it's always nice to have an MD. I said, oh, fine, I'll go to med school for that reason. Terrible reason. Absolutely terrible reason to go to med school. But fortunately, when you get into med school, you're forced to go through things, and you start working with patients and people, and you kind of see where your skills fit in. And rehab medicine was a very collaborative, still used exercise physiology, but very collaborative style. That's what my style, it turns out, is. That's where I should have been.
Well, as a senior trying to figure out what I'm going to do next year, that's very helpful advice.
It'll work out.
I hope so.
As long as you keep turning, you know, even a ship's got to be moving. It's going to turn, you know, it's going to make a change in direction. And you'll be forced to make decisions. I have to decide what I could. You'll be forced to make those decisions. Yeah. And you'll decide them based on your interest and skills and desires.